Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Monday, the 5th of August. Coming up on the programme was poor communication to blame for the ANC's poor election showing. A night of Olympic sports agony for South Africa. In depth into the new PwC Global Hopes and Fears report. And yet another call for tourism to drive the entrepreneurial economy. Why can't we get this right? Well, we've heard this refrain so many times before. South Africa's high youth unemployment offers significant job creation and economic growth potential. So is there new thinking as far as this is concerned on the tourism side? Well, Christel Groman, Director of Advisory, Strategic and Development Consulting at BDO South Africa, believes that tourism could become South Africa's new top foreign currency earner. And she joins me on the program now. And firstly, then, given the fluctuations in global tourism due to factors like pandemics and economic downturns, how sustainable really is it to rely on tourism as a primary strategy for job creation? There is inherent risk here, surely.
There is. The most interesting thing is, though, Jeremy, if you look at all the years and all the different pandemics and impacts that we've had and economic fluctuation, it was only really with COVID that we saw a major downturn in global tourism. So it's actually quite a industry that can resist a lot of fluctuations and has shown itself up as being there. It may be that it changes slightly where people go, but they still go away on some of these trips and some of these vacations because I guess people need it. So COVID was the only time where we've really had major decreases. So if we have to say, does it a risk? It's a risk for all industries. Definitely no different than it would be for tourism.
Given the myriad advantages that South Africa has in the respect, why are we not getting this right then? What are we not accelerating in order to achieve the kind of vision that you've outlined?
So South Africa remains a long haul distance and it's like a long-haul tourism destination. So it always means that we have to try and get our part of any long-haul market. So therefore, it does make it more time. If you're in Europe, if you can just go somewhere else in Europe, you obviously gain a little bit longer holiday. So we often are a bucket list holiday destination. Yes, there are people that come back quite frequently. Once they've actually experienced the destination, they realize there's so much more to do. But it's really getting over that element. And I think, you know, more recently, having lost a lot of airline seats during the COVID process, it's a lot about bringing access back. And access is both in respect of visas. We still do not have the right visa system. We are not getting the tourists in fast enough and without major issues to some extent and to the right countries, and also then just the seats. So it's quite expensive still then to come to South Africa because there's not enough competition on the airline arena.
Promises have been made that the visa regime is going to be corrected, and there are indications that that is starting to happen. So in terms of getting over the long-haul challenge, do you think it's a marketing job, an incentivization job, or is there more to it?
I think it's a combination. I think we need to make sure that tour operators that handle this country, as well as, say, for the conference market, big PCOs, where they're trying to bring events here, we need to give them assurance that we won't suddenly change it again and make it more difficult, so that if they bring their delegates and they bring their tourists, they're going to find this in a year's time or 2 years' time when they're booking ahead, they're not going to suddenly have a different story than what we're telling them now. So I think that consistency is important. I do agree with you. There are changes afloat, specifically on the visa side. I think we can do far more. I think the meetings industry, as part of the tourism industry, has a great role to play. And we can look at maybe doing specific visas for that market, because that market just doesn't just bring tourism or holiday tourism. It brings business. It brings trade. And that is very important for the country as well. So I think there definitely is ways that it's going. We wish it can be faster, but definitely the visa plays a big role.
Aside from that, the tourism industry, or the potential of tourism in this country, is something that is that can be capitalized on by young entrepreneurs. I think that you do make that point. But many, though, face
yes.
significant barriers, limited access to capital, mentorship, the list goes on and on. How do you address those issues on a larger scale to ensure that the potential of tourism startups is fully realized?
So I think one of the things that always happens is that everybody wants to go for the sexy tourist. Everybody wants to know that they're dealing with the foreign tourist, and they forget that we have a very strong internal visitor economy. Actually, if you look at the South African research on our own market, about 48% of our tourists are below the age of 35. Mm. Sorry. So they are actually youth, according to our country. If you look at our international market, where we've always thought they're a bit older, they're actually not anymore. And 56% are actually below the ages of 35. So my belief is that the youth will know what the youth wants, and we need to start getting them in more. I know there are big operations like hotels, casinos, building conference centers. All of this needs big capital investment. But if you look at the tourism value chain, right from tourism planning to the end of writing your memories, doing social media, etc., when they're in the destination, there are parts that you can do that actually doesn't need major capital investment. So to start to look at, maybe it's not just a job, maybe I need to look at it as a business, and I need to connect with other small businesses and then find some of these bigger operators. I came across a operator. We were having a discussion on the MICE industry, and particularly in the incentives industry. And I've seen a lovely way that a young gentleman that set him up for tours in Langa is now working with an incentive house, and the trips that he takes people on, if they do anything around the Cape area, as an incentive trip. And he's a small part of the bigger trip, but it starts to grow his business. And I think that is more or less what you need to look at. I mean, and they organize vehicles, etc. So basically what he needs to do is just to do the experience, and to do that well. So I think there are opportunities. It's a way of going and looking for it, rather than trying to do the old way of, I just want a job.
I think what you're also telling me is that more interconnectedness needs to be recognized in terms of the bigger value chain. The problem, of course, is early failure, particularly among small business. And then once yes. they've got a foothold, it's to make sure that sustainability is guaranteed. Not always easy to achieve, I'm sure you'll agree.
No, it's not easy to achieve. And I think we do have to accept that businesses will go. Some will survive and some won't survive. I do agree that connectedness, that collaboration, I think there are associations that can set that up. But it also needs, I think sometimes we think we must just go after programs where there's government money behind it, but there's a lot that can be done within the industry itself. And to find out about those mentorships within associations that you could also access, and then growing it, but not expecting that everything is going to happen overnight. You know, a slow growth, finding your niche opportunity. And as I say, I think there could be a lot more niches, given that such a big part of our tourism industry is actually the youth. I would think that they should know better what youth would like, how they would like to book, and therefore bringing them in is actually, to the older and more traditional players, is a must. If your market is getting younger, I don't understand why we're not bringing them in, because we need those fresh ideas. We need those different ideas of how do we actually do what I would rather like to refer to as the visitor economy than tourist economy, because everybody thinks a tourist is somebody on holiday. And actually, it's so much broader. It's business, medical. A lot of people, especially within South Africa, travel for religious reasons. So there's a lot of tourism that actually happens. And you don't just have to look at the international market. There's a big local market as well that you can support.
Well, lots of food for thought there. You've raised a number of interesting points. Christelle Le Grommen, Director of Advisory, Strategic and Development Consulting, BDO South Africa. Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's stay on an employment theme. And across Africa, a majority of the workforce feels ready to adapt to new ways of working, is excited about opportunities to learn and grow into their role, and has experienced recent changes that make them feel more optimistic about the future of the company they work for. Just some of the key findings emerging from the PwC Global Workforce Hopes and Fears Survey 2024. More now from Dr. Dylan Govender, who is PwC Africa People and Organization Leader. Dr. Govender, welcome. And first of all, what do we mean by new ways?
Yeah, I think there's quite a bit of optimism around the huge population, or rather the workforce from an Africa perspective, saying they're excited about the new ways of working. I guess the new ways of working really entail digitization in terms of the hybrid ways of working post-COVID world, where we can work online, provided we have the digital assets to be able to do that, and are quite productive in terms of, from a performance perspective, in terms of the way organizations are interacting with them and they contributing to the bigger picture as well. I say in the post-COVID world as well, a lot of things have changed, not just the ways of working, but the ways people are being measured in terms of performance. And they seem to be quite pleased. But I think the big attribute of there is around the digitization, around automation, around Gen AI, specifically like Chat GPT and DALL-E as well.
So much has changed, but difficult surely to reconcile this with the number of people who simply feel overwhelmed by the pace of change and maybe even fail or struggle to understand its rationale.
No, absolutely. And if you looked at the African cut in terms of the statistics, there's a lot of anxiety among the workforce from an Africa perspective. They're quite nervous about the rapid pace of change. So change is inevitable, as we all know. But I think the concern from them is the pace at which it's happening. So almost on a weekly basis, you're getting new structures that are put together, new operating models, new ways of working, adjustment in policies, procedures. So I guess, Jeremy, what's happening is that they're feeling overwhelmed. There's an anxiety around how quick these changes are happening, and are they able to cope and to embrace these changes on an ongoing basis?
There might be a level of anxiety, but interestingly, the report also says that job satisfaction has increased, but also highlights that 45% of those surveyed have little or nothing left for savings or for extras. It's difficult to find the disconnect between job satisfaction and financial stability. What is the report saying?
Yeah, interesting. The report, as you alluded to the fact that, there's a great degree of satisfaction in the ways of working. And I guess hybrid and having the ability to work from home has been a good thing. But everything comes at a price, Jeremy. I mean, if you look on the mental health side, you've seen burnout and mental health issues become a reality. And I guess that's the sacrifice of not just working from home, but working long hours from home, extended hours compared to what you would normally be doing if you were in the office, traveling through traffic, having a coffee at the office, engaging with the fellow colleagues. So absolutely, there's a bit of a conundrum. Your other point was around the fact that you're quite right, and this was a shocking one for me. A substantial 45% of the African workforce say they have little or nothing left over for savings, holidays, or extras. And this has serious implications, Jeremy, for employers and around the employee value proposition. How do you keep people engaged, even if at an extent of not being able to pay them? And this calls for, I guess, attention to the macroeconomic policies at a government level as well.
So how do you keep them engaged? Do you have any thoughts in that respect?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as PwC, we're a big employee of youngsters of the workforce as well. We've come up with new innovative. Now, let me just first say, Jeremy, that the old policies and procedures around employee value proposition and around recognition is not necessarily valid and relevant at this point in time. We're looking at the workforce wanting immediate gratification. They're looking at ways not necessarily to go up the corporate ladder, but looking at moving laterally in terms of specialized skill. So what we've done is we've looked at career pathing in different kind of different lens. We looked at ways in which to recognize and reward people for the specialism and the specialized skills they bring into the organization, even from a remuneration perspective. And so they don't have to go up the corporate ladder to be earning more money in terms of the specialism they bring through. I think the second point is we often assume that HR, human resources, is the, you know, the custodian to keep people engaged. But gone are those days, because the workforce is now looking for engagement from a business perspective. What that means is that leaders in business need to pivot and become more engaged with their workforce, have the career conversation, do more mentoring and coaching, understand what the youngsters' aspirations are and so forth. We live in a personalized age of employment. And having done this survey for a number of years, we know never before that we have such a personalized age of employment where employees are looking for value propositions that can, you know, almost sync with their own values and purpose. They're asking the question around, what is your organization doing in terms of goodwill from a societal purpose perspective? So we're doing a lot of work in that space, and we're involving our workforce to become active in that space so they get true value from what they're doing.
You talk about the age of personalization, but the report also says that over 50% of the African workforce anticipates significant job impact from technologies like generative AI, for instance. So the difficulty, Dr. Govind, I imagine, is how businesses can ensure that these technological changes that you've already referred to lead to job creation rather than job displacement. And that, I would suggest to you, is the big fear.
Absolutely. You spot on, Jeremy. It's a big fear. And we know in our country, as South Africa, we've got what I refer to as the endemic, which is the whole thing around unemployment crisis that we sit with. And it's a conundrum again. So once again, it is something that, you know, we need to embrace modern ways of working, technology as well, but not at the expense of, you know, letting go of jobs and letting people go out to be contributing to the unemployment rate, which is a perpetual one at the moment. So what's important is to find a synergy, and how do we, yes, adopt new ways of working from a technological perspective, but how do we skill our people up in other facets of skills that will be required and relevant even to work in synergy with machine or with automation? And that's critical, because we cannot do things the way we've been doing in many years in terms of training, capacity building, and empowerment. We need to ensure that some jobs will become irrelevant because automation and AI will take over that. But in order to give more certainty to employees, I think it's a twofold thing, Jeremy. Employees need to start looking into the interest of how they skill their people up, but individuals need to see ways of skilling themselves up in terms of embracing new technology, but also embracing the new facets of learning that's coming through. I mean, it lends itself to this whole concept of skills first, skills-based organization. And quite interesting, in South Africa, we're seeing a huge shift both in public and private sector, where they're focusing more on skills that people bring to the table and competencies, rather than just the qualification or the role they performed in the past.
Dr. Dayalan Govind, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, from the workplace now to politics, and the African National Congress has been doing some serious introspection about its dismal election performance, citing the rise of the MK Party, poor service delivery, load shedding, and dwindling activism. The party has also put the blame on its communications department. Now, Chris Vick is chairperson of the non-profit comms agency Mobilize, and also a former government communicator. Chris, welcome. And first of all, then, do you agree with that premise around communications?
Well, it's a double-edged sword, right? I don't think ANC communications is at its peak at the moment, but at the same time, it's a very hard project to sell, you know. If the ANC was governing well, was in touch with people, and was dealing with the real social issues and dealing with the economy, the communications task would be easier. But the conduct influences the communication. And with a weak communications team, a weak political leadership, and some very bad government decisions, I don't think it's either or. I think it's both.
If you are not delivering optimally as a political party, then how does your communication strategy need to change?
Well, I think one of the clear areas of weakness in the ANC's election campaign was clarifying some of the strange decisions that were being taken, providing context and helping people understand. Whereas the ANC comms was very brittle. It was sort of, I think it was aimed at supporters and in a very hopeful way. It wasn't aimed at winning people over. So there was very little attempt to convince people of what was going on. It was sort of believe or don't. That's very untypical of previous ANC election campaigns. I think a lot of work went into helping people understand not only what was being done about inequality and about poverty and poor health and poor education, but why certain decisions were being taken. And it was often the why questions that weren't being answered.
And if you were to draw a comparison between what the ANC was either doing or not doing compared to other parties, what would the difference be?
Well, each political party has different constituencies, so obviously the messaging would be different and the emphasis would be different. But, you know, I think the EFF was quite successful in speaking to its converted about the dream that it still holds out. MK, the surprise package of the elections, I think it was essentially another coalition of the wounded. So any work that went into organizing and communicating was essentially to try and portray the ANC as having sold out the poor and forgotten about particular constituencies. The DA, I spent a lot of time studying the election manifestos of the various political parties, and I must say, very few of them put much effort into it. The DA seemed to rely on the kind of doomsaying, the moonshot pact, prevent an ANC, EFF alliance, etc. There wasn't that much about what the DA itself was doing. And most of the messaging there was, look at what we've done in the Western Cape, not addressing issues of racism head on, not addressing some of the internal difficulties that black members in particular were experiencing. So, as I say, sort of customized to their own constituencies, very issue-based, but it wasn't a very inspiring political election from a communications point of view. You know, there were no sort of breakthrough moments. There were, apart from MK, there were no real surprises in what was being offered. And I think that's why we ended up with such a fragmented political makeup, you know, a GNU with so many diverse members.
Do you think there was a broad enough understanding as far as the ANC is concerned, but also other political parties, about the power of social media and whether they captured the potential and the momentum sufficiently?
I don't think so, Jeremy. I think it was very underused. I don't know what was happening in WhatsApp groups, but certainly on X, Instagram, TikTok, it wasn't resonating, and it particularly wasn't resonating with young people. I think some of the smaller parties like Rise and Mzansi did a better job, I think probably because they have younger members who understand these sorts of things. But there seems to be an aversion to social media. I mean, you know as well as I do that Twitter or X is pretty much a theater of hate, and it's very difficult to land positive messages there. But again, you know, there are clever and creative ways, which I think Rise and Mzansi tapped into, where you can demonstrate, in a sense, the organizational culture that you represent, not just the views and the ideologies and the policies, but the energy that you would bring to politics. But it still seems very much uncharted territory for South African political parties. The solution seems to be, well, let's get the most famous face onto those platforms and let's use sound bites. There are much more creative ways of doing it, by getting conversations going. And the engagement and the conversations weren't happening, except in a very positional way. Again, they weren't sweeping people up, challenging their thinking and putting forward new thinking that would increase support or build support in new areas.
Chris, good external communication is predicated on internal communication being aligned. How can the ANC get that right to make sure that all its members are following the same chart and are informed about strategic objectives and challenges going forward? Again, if you buy that premise.
I think there are a few problems. I mean, the ANC is not a united entity, so it's difficult to get a consistent set of messages out of an organization that is sometimes almost at war with itself. Internal communication and external communication have both been neglected by the ANC for several years. There's the occasional newsletter that comes out, the occasional tweet, but the service to members is very poor, as I think it is with many political parties. And again, that's where social media can be incredibly effective. But getting the balance right between what's being communicated internally and getting conversations going rather than just diktats from head office is a major challenge for the ANC. And it made it difficult. I mean, the ANC branch that I fall under, and I'm no longer a member, but that branch couldn't get it together, and neither could many other branches, just to get the election manifesto out. Never mind talking notes, organizers' notes, equipping people to go out and do recruitment work or mobilizing people to vote. But, I mean, propaganda, as we used to call it, was one of the major thrusts of the ANC's work during the struggle and immediately after we got rid of apartheid. But over the years, it's really become downscaled. And that's why, you know, I believe there's a political leadership issue. It's one thing to blame the communications team within the ANC, but without a clear strategy and without the leadership themselves understanding the script and sticking to the script, it's not going to make much difference. You know, I mean, I didn't get the sense that people who were on platforms speaking on behalf of the ANC, whether on radio and TV or on social media or in rallies, were particularly equipped with a script that they should stick to in terms of what to say. So you were getting mixed messages and you were getting contradictions. And look at where we ended up.
Chris Vick, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And let's finish the program with this. South Africa's premier sprinter, Akani Simbini, gave it his all in a historic Olympic 100-meter final where eight finishers all went under 10 seconds. But at the end, he did run a PB, 9.82 seconds, but finished fourth outside the medals. Someone who was in the stands, Kanti Mhlabiso, a researcher and also a sports fan. Kanti, welcome to you. So how did it feel watching this event? What was the atmosphere like in the stands? It must have been electric.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for having me. And indeed, it was very, very electric. I think just witnessing the sheer talent of these athletes is something that we can only marvel at. And of course, being able to see it live was really something that someone like me will treasure forever.
Please don't rub it in, because it's just the worst thing that you can do, because I really wished with every fiber of my being I could be there as well. What is it actually like watching a 100-meter final? I mean, over in, 9 seconds or so, and the build-up is so astonishing, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, it's one of those things where people say, if you blink, the race is over. So we're all glued to our seats at least 30 minutes or so before the race even started. It really is an indication, of course, of the sheer talent of these athletes. And of course, the atmosphere itself was also very tense, but also very exciting as well, as the level of competition between the different athletes and, of course, the countries that are supporting there was magnifying.
Let me pull the lens back a little bit, if I can. You're someone, obviously, that's a sports fan, a supporter of South African athletics. This particular performance and maybe his impact on the sport, even if he didn't win a medal, it is going to be huge, isn't it? He's an icon and someone that the entire sporting firmament of this country can look up to.
That's spot on, Jeremy. I think that particularly athletes of color being able to represent and on such a global stage is something that is to be marveled at, for sure. I think that him making it that far in such a competitive I suppose, field as well, was something that I honestly can't imagine, the sheer sort of pride that we, as South Africans in particular, ought to have and be proud of him. You know, it's very, the just losing out on meddling just in, by a fraction of a second is something to me that I just can't get wrap my head around as well.
What's the overall experience been like in Paris? Obviously, not just on the track, but we've done well in the swimming pool. Have you been enjoying yourself? What's it been like?
It's really been amazing, Jeremy. I mean, I think our rand compared to the euro isn't doing that great. but certainly in terms of the atmosphere that's been created, the way in which sort of the logistical part of it as well. So I was lucky enough to also and witness to watch our ladies hockey play against the US of A, which we unfortunately lost. But even just, you know, organizing an event of this magnitude has been something that's really been, it's something to applaud, because seamlessly, both in terms of the transport of getting there, assistance for those of us who don't speak French has also been good in the various metro stations, etc. But also looking at the more sort of social environmental aspects as well, it's been a quite a very sustainable practices being implemented here, and of course the overall diversity of the people that you see within the fan parks and across the general city as a whole has really been something that the French government can certainly be proud of.
I was going to ask you what you paid for a baguette and a beer, but I don't want to upset you too much.
I'll be living on a diet of water when I'm back in South Africa.
Nice talking to you, and enjoy the rest of the event. That is Nhlanhla Mhlabiso. He's a researcher in Paris, but also, as you can hear, not talking to him about research, but about being a dyed-in-the-wool South African sports fan. And that also informed our last online poll on the program. I asked you on Friday if there was enough government and commercial support for South African Olympians. Yes, no, or we need a new strategy. And I'm not really surprised at this. Close on 90% of our respondents saying there is little support for Team South Africa. And today, this also relates to an interview we did a little earlier. Was, in your opinion, poor communication to blame for the ANC's election woes? Yes, no, or a whole lot more than just that. If you have a view, please go to our X or LinkedIn pages, put your mark, and I will bring you the results of that poll tomorrow. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.